Colleagues, your very presence here, for only the fourth time in the Security Council's history that foreign ministers have assembled, symbolizes, I think, the seriousness of the present situation. I would like to begin today's discussion with a quotation that I think aptly sets the context for our discussions today. The quotation is as follows. There is no precedent for a people being the victim of such injustice and of being at present threatened by abandonment to an aggressor. Also, there has never before been an example of any government proceeding with the systematic extermination of a nation by barbarous means in violation of the most solemn promises made to all the nations of the earth, that there should be no resort to a war of conquest, and that there should not be used against innocent human beings terrible poison and harmful gases. Close quotation. Those words, I think, could well have come from the Emir of Kuwait, but they do not. They were spoken instead in 1936, not in 1990. They come from Haile Selassie, the leader of Ethiopia, a man who saw his country conquered and occupied, much like Kuwait has been brutalized since August the 2nd. Sadly, colleagues, that appeal to the League of Nations fell ultimately upon deaf ears. The League's efforts to redress aggression failed, and international disorder and war ensued. History has now given us another chance. With the Cold War behind us, we now have the chance to build a world which was envisioned by the founders of this organization, by the founders of the United Nations. We have the chance to make this Security Council and this United Nations true instruments for peace and for justice across the globe. We must not let the United Nations go the way of the League of Nations. We must fulfill our common vision of a peaceful and just post-Cold War world. But if we are to do so, we must meet the threat to international peace created by Saddam Hussein's aggression. And that is why the debate that we are about to begin will, I think, rank as one of the most important in the history of the United Nations. It will surely do much to determine the future of this body. Our aim today must be to convince Saddam Hussein that the just and humane demands of this council and of the international community cannot be ignored. If Iraq does not reverse its course peacefully, then other necessary measures, including the use of force, should be authorized. We must put the choice to Saddam Hussein in unmistakable terms. Now, in accordance with the decisions taken previously on this item, I invite the permanent representative of Iraq to the United Nations to take a seat at the council table. I invite the distinguished Deputy Premier and Minister for Foreign Affairs of Kuwait to take a seat at the council table.
Secretary of State Baker has just invited the Foreign Minister of Kuwait, along with the ambassador from Iraq, to sit at the UN Security Council table. Neither one of those nations is a member of the Security Council at this time, but because this conflict obviously affects them both, they are being invited, and in a moment, they are both going to be invited to speak. You'll hear from Kuwait and from Iraq.
Item two of the agenda. Members of the council have before them document S/2169, which contains the text of a draft resolution submitted by Canada, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, the United States of America, Romania, and France have joined as sponsors of the draft resolution contained in document S/21969. The first speaker inscribed on my list is the distinguished Deputy Premier and Minister for Foreign Affairs of Kuwait. I welcome His Excellency, and I give him the floor.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of God,
Sayyid al-Rais, أصحاب السعادة, وزراء خارجية الدول الأعضاء, الأخوة أعضاء الوفود, باسم الكويت أحييكم وأنقل لكم التقدير الصادق من شعبها الصامد في وجه العدوان العراقي وتمنياتها بالتوفيق لكم, متطلعا لمداولاتكم, آملا بأن يخرج من هذا اللقاء التاريخي صوت المجتمع الدولي في وقفة تاريخية واحدة منددا بالعدوان, معبرا عن تصميمه على مواجهته, مؤكدا بأن المستقبل هو لسيادة القانون, وأن العلاقات الدولية ستقوم على مبادئ الميثاق وعلى الشرعية الدولية وعلى التفاهم والحوار وحل المشاكل بالوسائل السلمية. صوتكم هو رسالة إلى شعب الكويت
its struggle to eliminate oppression and tyranny and in reinforcing its aspirations to overcome the plight of occupation. While with my greetings to you, I express the profound gratitude and appreciation of the people of Kuwait and its hope that tomorrow will be a better day and that the present suffering will be a lesson for the whole world, that the time in which resort to force and insistence on obstinacy, resistance, and aggression are all forms of behavior that belong to the past, and that the international community will no longer tolerate or accept any of them. Mr. President, may I express on behalf of Kuwait to you a sincere acknowledgement of the key role played by the United States during its stewardship of the Security Council during the month of November. On a personal note, let me commend you, sir, for your laudable effort to underscore the vital role of the Council and its effectiveness as an instrument of preserving, indeed imposing, if necessary, peace and security in the world. The people of Kuwait extends its thanks to you and to your country. This sense of acknowledgement was reflected in the welcome speech made by His Highness Sheikh Jaber Al Ahmed, the Emir of the State of Kuwait, upon receiving a week ago President Bush in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. May I quote a few words from that speech? Quote, I commend the decisive role played by the United States of America, its people and government, by facing up to aggression and repelling it. This American stand did not come from a vacuum, because you are the descendants of those trailblazing immigrants who centuries ago preferred to risk and endanger their lives by immigrating to a remote and unknown world, rather than submitting to oppression that shackles their freedoms. By doing so, they instituted a heritage of countering injustice and aggression. Their hopes for building a free world that rejects humiliation and refuses tyranny were realized, and it had become a refuge for all freedom lovers. Today, the descendants reflect the historic passage of their ancestors to dissipate the darkness cast on the land of the free people by the specters of dictatorship and injustice, in keeping sincerely with their forefathers' custom and heritage. End of quotation. Also, I should like to pay tribute to the important role played by the United Kingdom during its presidency of the Council during the past month. Here, I would like to sit on record for the friendly government of Great Britain, with whom my country has long-standing historical ties, our deep appreciation for its brave and just stand on the side of the Kuwaiti right. Mr. President, I should also like to take this opportunity to pay tribute to all the foreign ministers who took the trouble to travel from far places to attend in person this meeting, thus underlining the importance of this historic session today. To each and every one of them, the people of Kuwait are indebted for they perceive in your presence here and now an expression of support, a solace for the pain, and a redress for the injustice. Mr. President, the Council convenes today to express its resolve that the principles of the United Nations Charter are in play as a concrete reality, and that words would be transformed into tangible deeds, and concepts are, and the theory of collective security indeed will be the framework that regulates the international relations, and that people will rest assured that the stronger will not prey on the weaker, and that those who harbor intentions to commit aggression will carefully and profoundly weigh the odds against them before they resort to force, because they now know in no uncertain terms that the world, indeed the entire world, will reverse their aggression and face up to their adventures. The Security Council meets today under the provisions of the 7th chapter of the Charter, which regulates international relations, and in such a way that allows no room for aggression, no acceptance of the use of force, and no tolerance towards those who tamper with the principles of the Charter. In this connection, I should like to pay tribute to those countries that contributed to the multinational force, thus demonstrating their commitment to the supremacy of the rule of law, to the consolidation of peace, and to the determination to prove by deed that aggression, arrogance, and oppression are forms of behavior that belong to the Middle Ages and have no place at all in the 1990s. The multinational force is a concrete translation of the will of the international community, that aggression stands to lose, and that resort to the use of force will ensure nothing but destruction. Kuwait participates in today's meeting while fully recognizing that peace is constructive work and war is destruction, and that prosperity first and foremost depends on stability, and economic and social progress depend on stability. Kuwait has been the victim of aggression and invasion because mainly it sought to solve its problems through dialogue and understanding, and we were confident that force could not indeed be used by another Arab country, by a neighbor with whom we have always had common bonds of brotherhood and neighborly mutual relations, let alone our common heritage. Mr. President, since the Iraqi brutal aggression against Kuwait and its occupation and annexation by military force, this council meets for the second time at the foreign minister's level. This in itself is indeed a highly significant event, an event that reflects the true nature of the aggression that you are now discussing, its implications, dimensions, repercussions, and effects on world and peace. This aggression has not been restricted to the occupation of the home of the national territory. Indeed, from the very first day of the invasion, there has been an uninterrupted string of acts of killing, torture, expulsion, and brutalization of the peaceful people of Kuwait, which rejected occupation and proudly showed no willingness whatsoever to cooperate with the occupiers. Quite the contrary, the people of Kuwait began to mount resistance by civil disobedience, thus graphically demonstrating its rejection of occupation, and this has proved the most effective weapon yet. But the response of the Iraqi aggression showed no sense of mercy or compassion, indeed no respect for the divine or human codes of conduct. This perhaps explains the havoc wreaked by its forces and the wide large-scale destruction they brought about throughout Kuwait. The Iraqi troops also confiscated individual rights and freedoms and started to causing destruction and plundering all types of movable assets and transferring these assets to Iraq in a systematic campaign in order to destroy the economic and social infrastructure of Kuwait. The militant policies pursued by the aggressor sought to ensure that these crude atrocities would instill terror and alarm that would prompt Kuwaitis by force and coercion to leave their property and assets to be pillaged by these wild beasts. Those forces started to confiscate all identity documents and burning them and transferring large numbers of Iraqis and foreigners to replace the Kuwaitis and settle in their homeland and live in their homes in a systematic campaign in order to destroy and transform the demographic structure of Kuwait. Perhaps in the past 2 days, you have seen for yourselves some aspects of the tragedy which my compatriots in Kuwait are living through at this moment, as outlined by eyewitnesses who have languished under the oppression of occupation and suffered from its brutal practices. All that is but a minuscule model of the daily practices against the people of Kuwait by the it shows its total indifference to the value systems and codes of conduct, both Islamic and international. Against all these odds, we draw our inner strength from the fact, first, that our cause is a just one, and second, that the overwhelming international support we have received and the determination to defeat aggression, irrespective of the price, will ensure the restoration of our legitimate rights. It is true that Kuwait is a tiny state in terms of its size and population, but thanks to this massive and overwhelming international support, which is being rendered by you on the basis that justice is the true shield of peace now, we find that Kuwait is indeed a power that carries significant weight. Mr. President, since the Iraqi aggression, your council adopted in an unprecedented manner 11 resolutions under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, demanding that Iraq must withdraw fully, immediately, and unconditionally from Kuwait, and that the legitimate government of Kuwait should be restored. Some of those resolutions aimed at forcing Iraq to comply with the international will by peaceful means, by imposing total trade and economic sanctions against Iraq, together with other measures. That system of sanctions was but a means to an end and not a goal in itself. Your Council's resolutions have been taken at one and the same time with other similar resolutions taken at the pan-Arab and pan-Islamic level and within the framework of the non-aligned movement on the same basis of the Security Council resolutions 660 and 662. In addition to those resolutions, there have been initiatives, personal initiatives and endeavors undertaken by prominent international and regional persons, including the Secretary General of the United Nations and envoys from the Soviet Union, China and other countries, all aiming at persuading the Iraqi leadership to respect the international will. But alas, all those efforts ran against a stone wall of Iraqi intransigence, while aggression and occupation remain in place, shaking the very foundations of regional stability as the people and population of Kuwait continue to undergo untold suffering. Efforts in the same vein have also been made by some Arab states whose positions are not totally in line with the Security Council resolutions and who have kept the channels of dialogue with Baghdad open. Despite all those efforts and good offices, the Iraqi regime persists in its intransigence and obstinacy, rejecting all overtures, disdaining all peaceful attempts, and thumbing its nose at the world community and the shrugging off the international will. Security Council resolutions mean nothing to it. showing no respect and no sensitivity toward economic and rendering homeless hundreds of thousands of people for too many nationalities, plunging the entire region towards a horrible conflict in order to attain its malicious aspirations and maintain its hegemony and confrontational poise. The atrocities of the Iraqi regime, which has run amok, go far beyond all accepted norms of civilized behavior as set forth in legal instruments. Having no respect for the human person, its dignity and rights, it sought to mete out revenge against some states by detaining the nationals who were present in Kuwait and Iraq and took them as hostages and now denies them their fundamental freedoms. It has subjected them to torture and intimidation by using some hostages as human shields, held against their will as guests at certain strategic installations. This is perhaps a new form of degrading treatment. Now, the Iraqi regime is using these human beings as bargaining chips, offering to release some of them as a blackmail ploy and as a tactic to divert attention from its aggression against Kuwait. Mr. President, Your Excellencies, the Foreign Minister's brothers and sisters, after all these efforts and all these resolutions and that time, which is measured by my people in minutes as they continue to bleed profusely, no one really can now claim that the international community has not given to Iraq full opportunity to comply with the international will, or, for that matter, that the world community has not offered good feasible grounds for a peaceful settlement and the elimination of the prospects for war and saving the region a real Holocaust, the consequences of which no one perhaps can predict except God the Almighty. No one can really claim, nor can anyone really claim, that the international community did not pay due attention to any forthcoming signals or really meaningful Iraqi initiatives in response to the Security Council resolutions. Channels of communication with the Iraqi regime are full of good prospects for achieving a just, peaceful settlement. Indeed, there are many formulae and avenues that can indeed lead to peace. But the intransigence of the Iraqi regime is the real reason that is pushing the region at this point to a conflagration that we do not want to see, but it's being imposed upon us, for it now seems to be the only avenue to ensure the restoration of our rights. Mr. President, the Iraqi regime has sought to deflect attention against from its crime against world peace and its crime by invoking issues that have nothing to do with its aggression against Kuwait, like citing the danger of the foreign presence in the region. Iraq is the first to know that it is the real reason for that presence. It cited question of hostages in order to create a humanitarian issue without paying due attention to their dignity. Indeed, it dragged them into its adventurous schemes in a desperate attempt to link between its aggression against Kuwait and its occupation and the expulsion of its people and the question of Palestine, which is, alas, the first victim of its aggression. It continues to exploit it for a cheap propaganda ploy. It calls for an Arab solution, which is the first to dissent from and reject later and then utilize that following sowing the seeds of dissension into Arab ranks. Crude exploitation of these questions exposed the tactics of the Iraqi regime to gain time and to cause divisiveness and playing on emotions and sentiments. But the Arab world, Islamic world, and the international community found out the truth, defined the road, set the goals, and demonstrated firm unity in resolve. And this is represented, Mr. President, in the draft resolution now before the Council. The message contained in this draft resolution is indeed a message that gives peace a new chance, that would make us skillfully snatch it from total darkness imposed on our region by the Iraqi regime. Indeed, it is a flash of hope that will not dim. It is a torch of light that will guide all of us out of the dark tunnel into which the Iraqi regime has trended us all into. The Iraqi regime has disregarded the appeals by people to comply with the resolutions passed by this August Council and responded to the cries of those who suffer from the harshness of occupation in my country, Kuwait, and its vicious invading forces continue to sabotage every prospect for peace. Therefore, the international community represented by the Security Council should now feel free at this stage to use all necessary means available to it and in cooperation with my government as provided for in the draft resolution in order to implement the resolutions adopted by this council in order to put an end to this flagrant challenge and the inadmissible opposition to the will of the international community, which refuses the use of force or the resort or threat of force as a form for dealing with others. Our goal is peace. Our Islamic faith advocates for peace and enjoins us to work earnestly and sincerely for peace. But by the same token, true Islam makes it imperative upon all of us to resist aggression and not to yield in submission to the aggressor. Perhaps God the Almighty has defined for us a prescription for a fair and just recourse in the face of such an aggression. For God says in the Holy Quran, the speaker is quoting now, in the name of God, compassionate, the merciful, if two parties among the believers fall into a quarrel, make ye peace between them. But if one of them transgresses beyond bound against the other, then fight ye all against the one that transgresses until it complies with the command of God. But if it complies, then make peace between them with justice and be fair, for God loves those who are fair and just. End of quotation. Mr. President, today's meeting of the Security Council will represent a historic landmark. Your decision today will indeed lay down historic guidelines that will perhaps have their impact on the future of mankind. Therefore, may God the Almighty guide you along the right path and ultimately ensure success for your endeavors. Meantime, we pray to God the Almighty to inspire those who diverged from the course of righteousness to regain their senses and heed the cause for peace and respond to the requirements of justice. And our final prayer is to praise Allah, Lord of the universe. I thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the distinguished Deputy Premier and Minister for Foreign Affairs of Kuwait for his statement and as well for his kind words addressed to me. The next speaker inscribed on my list is the permanent representative of Iraq to the United Nations, to whom I give the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a privilege to address the Council in the presence of so many distinguished foreign ministers. Mr. Chairman, on October 25th, when the Council was debating Resolution 665, I addressed the Council trying to focus the attention of the Council on the legal requirement which the Council must observe in passing any resolution involving any use of force. Otherwise, I argued that the Council was acting beyond its jurisdiction and its act should be deemed null and void. For a better reason, I believe the same argument applies today. For under the UN Charter, any use of force would be deemed an act of aggression, except in three exclusive cases. The first case under Article 51, which involves self-defense and is limited in this case, that is the use of force, until the Security Council is seized with the matter. Beyond that, any use of force would be an act of aggression. Also, the Security Council can act in case the sanction passed in accordance with Article 41 proved to be ineffective or unenforceable, in which case the Council could act collectively under Article 42 by using force in accordance with the mechanism provided for in Article 43. In other words, in this case, only collective action under the command and control of the Security Council in coordination with the Staff Military Committee can use force against any other country, rather than authorizing individual member state to lynch any particular country for any reason. The third case, Mr. Chairman, was under Article 106, in which case, when the Council fails to reach special agreements with member countries in order to put their forces under the Security Council command, and then the four countries who signed the Moscow Declaration of October 1943, together with France and in consultation with the members of the UN, can undertake joint action against any particular country. These are the three exclusive cases where the use of force may be authorized by the Security Council in a legal manner. However, regrettably, the Council apparently thought that the legal requirement in this case are disposable niceties. This is why tonight I'm going to focus the attention on the political aspect of the dispute. I will read my speech now in Arabic, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President, your council convenes today at this lofty level to vote on a resolution which your government has steadily, tirelessly, and relentlessly endeavored to issue so that the council may judge Iraq as a state which does not want or desire peace. This stance means that Iraq knows nothing but the use of force. It is a tendentious stance, a deliberate and suspect distortion of the facts. My government has and continues to advocate peace. However, it is a comprehensive peace, a durable and just peace, which neither adds to or subtracts from the right of any party. The members of the Council are aware that a profound dialogue has only taken place between two of the permanent member states of the Council. As for the other three states, they have abstained from this dialogue, and I wish to mention the two, the United States of America especially. The United States of America has imposed an embargo and a blockade upon dialogue, upon debate with the government of my country. Rather, they have chosen the style of issuing orders and demands for implementation as if we were a branch of the American administration. This approach is totally rejected by us because it is a brazen violation of the principle of equality between the countries and peoples of the world. It is an infringement on the human fundamentals upon which international relations must be constructed. The American logic throttles any initiative for dialogue with a view to attaining a peaceful settlement either on the Arab or international levels. This logic stems from American imperialist considerations, which have become glaringly clear more than any time before, especially in our Arab region. This is reaffirmed by the fact that the premises of this policy of the United States and the arguments which it invokes and the objectives which it declares are self-contradictory. Their final outcome is to embody the approach of the double standard in dealing with cases of a similar nature for purely American interest considerations. Where is the new international order claimed by the United States and which is wittingly or unwittingly referred to by others? Where is the quality of order if what is required is to apply the approach of duplicitous policies, which by nature do not recognize by the justice and fair play? Where is the quality of international, of such an order, if the conclusion is to impose American hegemony and to submit others to American orders with a view to safeguarding the political, economic, and security interests of the United States in total disregard of the interest of others? Where is this novel quality of the order if its basic features beyond the European orbit mean the logic of arrogant and brutal power, which leaves no place for dialogue at a time where the Americans flaunt the so-called achievements in the European area, which are depicted as if they apply to the entire world by universal consensus over the planet as a whole? As a cover for their aggressive and imperialist policies in the region, the American president alleges that the crisis is not a stand of the United States against Iraq, but that the world stands against Iraq in a manner unprecedented in the annals of the United Nations. Such talk lays bare a fact that the small states, which do not enjoy veto power in the Security Council, which find no one to protect them from the superpower permanent members, are the only countries exposed to sanctions under Chapter 7 of the Charter. As an example, suffice it to refer to the fact that the United States is the power which forestalled international unanimity from imposing sanctions over lengthy years on the Zionist entity for its expansionist and aggressive policy, for the crimes it perpetrated since its inception against the right of the Palestinian and the Arab people at large. The current crisis has proven inter alia the hegemony, the full hegemony of the United States over the Security Council and its arbitrary and biased procedures. Yet at the same time, it has highlighted the independence of Iraq, the fact that Iraq is a non-aligned state in the true sense of the word, since it does not fall under the banner or protection of any of the superpower permanent members of the Security Council. Is it not indeed an ironic coincidence or bare premeditation that this meeting of the Council at this eminent level, a meeting which was called for and striven for by the United States by all means available to it, a meeting which it presides over, this day coincides with the International Day for Solidarity with the Palestinian People, at a time when the world at large knows that the United States of America is the sole power in the world which has impeded the issuing of just resolutions which safeguard the rights of the Palestinian people. And it is the power which has prevented the implementation of the many decisions adopted by these international organizations, especially your council, in spite of its limited nature, of the limited nature of the demands of these resolutions. Let us recall the objectives declared by the American administration and the justification for the build-up of its aggressive forces in the Holy Lands of Islam, how they have evolved from a claim to protect Saudi Arabia from a so-called Iraqi threat until the declaration that the objective is to safeguard American economic security in the field of energy, energy and employment, and finally the claim that Iraq has acquired nuclear weapons. There are aggressive forces and offensive forces. The differing objectives of the United States has led one American observer to state, and I quote,
"So much confusion that rational public response is impossible." Sayyid al-Rais,
Mr. President, our difference with the security in the item under consideration is that we reject this policy because it is a malicious policy, it is a brutal and aggressive policy. The members of the Council are duty-bound to recall how the United States dealt with the rights of the Palestinian people over the lengthy history of their cause in the United Nations, especially in recent times when the most recent Israeli crimes against the children of the stones and the children of the uprising have been dealt with. Such an American attitude, as well as its allies, is but dilatory maneuvers, attempts at impeding resolutions which would have resolved the matter in the correct manner to protect the Palestinian people. Of course, the objective is to protect Israel, its crimes, and its aggressive policy. In this context, we hear nothing mentioned about the Charter, about international relations, about the new international order. Hence, the logic is that all are equal, but some are more equal. Here we pose the question, why Iraq alone? This is on one side. On another side, we need a clear statement from the statement. Since Resolution 660 of the 2nd of August, we have had hasty decisions, one after another. Our people, distinguished delegates, believe that your resolutions would not have assumed such velocity had it not been for effort, American efforts at exerting pressure, pressure which the Americans are proud of every day, until we only hear emanations from the United States. Our people are fully aware that some in this body and in the world organization is concerned at the manifestations of hegemony within the Security Council, as if it were a reflection of the opinion of the international community. Some are asking the question on the role of the members of the world organizations who have given their voices to the selection of the representatives at a time where they stand helplessly concerning upholding the principles of the Charter. Our people are also asking the question, how does this body adopt one resolution after another at a time when the foreign minister of Iraq is prevented under false pretexts to give his position before you produce your judgments? The impression is that the Council has dealt with the causes of the Arab people in a special way, with a double standard. Before our view, we see how the Council is dealing with Israeli usurpation of Palestinian and Arab rights. It is indeed a painful paradox in the international organization and the Security Council, which is entrusted with the maintenance of international peace and security, that the Council is but a willing tool in the hands of the American administration at a time when this very administration was unable until now to convince the American Congress to resort to the use of force at this phase. President George Bush hopes to exploit the Security Council to influence the decision of the Congress and to achieve its blessings to use force. We ask once again, where is this new international order? The massing of American forces, their deployment in the Gulf region, the threats of invasion and destruction of Iraq, the setting of a deadline as an ultimatum is similar to a police action rather than a serious and responsible attempt to resolve the problems of the region. Here it is appropriate to refer to the statement of the member of the American Congress, an expert in American wars, Mr. Bob Carey, commenting on the build-up.
Because it forsakes the potential of a new world order in favor of the tactics of the old order, rather than relying on diplomacy, cooperation, and multilateral regulation of armed flows, we will, that's Americans, we will revert primarily to reliance on U.S. troops and U.S. armed sales. End quote.
Mr. President, Iraq calls for peace. It desires peace. Not for us alone, but for the entire Middle East region. Iraq advocates such a peace. We desire such a peace on the basis of the implementation of all Security Council resolutions in a just manner and in keeping with one standard based on justice and fairness. Allow me to quote here a statement of a senior American diplomat, Mr. George Kennan, who says,
"In thinking about international affairs, is not to make moral judgments or apportion blame, but to understand the nature of the forces at work as the foundation for thinking about what, if anything, can be done." End quote.
Iraq has embodied this approach in the initiative declared by Mr. Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq, on the 12th of August. He proposed an integrated and comprehensive manner for dealing with all the problems of the Middle East through the Security Council and on the basis of international law, so as to safeguard the legitimate rights and interests of all parties, so that the people of the region may enjoy peace, stability, prosperity now and in the future. The American administration has rejected this initiative before even examining it. It has imposed its refusal upon others. The problems of the Middle East are not isolated one from the other. It has common historic roots. What is tangible is that one problem is often the cause for the eruption of other problems. It could also be the result of the vestiges of a chronic problem that remains without solution. Therefore, the linkage between problems is a natural and logical method. Any separation is artificial. It disregards the organic link, the historic link, and the political link between these problems. The American refusal of this reality is prompted by a suspicious motivation that has no link with the interests of the people of the Middle East. It is a premeditated policy to impose domination on the fate of a region for purely imperialist designs. It is indeed an exercise in political hypocrisy that the American position embodies a contrary or opposite linkage with the problems of the Middle East, since they call for separation. At the same time, they try always at procrastination to avoid the resolution of the Palestinian problem, in spite of the fact that Palestinian blood is shed every day, as well as the continuation unimpeded of Israeli crimes. Is this because we are Arabs? Is this because the problems of the Middle East cannot be resolved by one standard, the standard of of international law and the Charter, which the United States alleges to espouse, in spite of the fact that the Council has not given us the attention we merit. It is necessary for the Council to know that we are not tactically trying to deflect any attention from other questions. The crux of the matter, supported by the Arab masses, as well as by many other countries of the world, I wish to give you one picture of the support for our viewpoint, which we have received. And this is reflected in the statement made by the National Council of Churches in the United States, which represents 42 million American citizens. In the middle of November, they have stressed the need to hold an international conference to deal with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It has accused the American administration of duplicity and hypocrisy because they are calling for the withdrawal of Iraqi forces according to Security Council resolution in total disregard of the need for requesting the withdrawal of Israeli forces from the occupied territories in the West Bank, Jerusalem, Sinai, Golan, and southern Lebanon. The Council of Churches have reaffirmed in their statement, and I quote,
cries out for a U.S. policy that seeks to redress all causes of injustice, including those of Israel and Palestine, Lebanon, and Cyprus. والسؤال الذي يجب أن يطرح هو
The question which must be raised now is the following. Will the Security Council rise to the level of responsibility for imposing a just and lasting peace through an integrated approach to dealing with all the problems of the region? The response to this question constitutes your historic mission on our part. We are continuing on our road. Peace is our goal. We work for it. We desire it. If war is imposed upon us, if war is imposed upon us by the United States, this will be our destiny. I wish to reaffirm to you that our people will not kneel. We will rise to the level of responsibility because we are calling for a right. We are defending this right against injustice and tyranny. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank the permanent representative of Iraq to the United Nations for his statement. It is my understanding that the Council is ready to proceed to the vote on the draft resolution before it. And unless I hear any objection, I shall put the draft resolution to the vote now. There being no objection, it is so decided. I shall first give the floor to those members of the Council who wish to make statements before the voting. I give the floor to the permanent representative of Yemen to the United Nations.
Mr. President, it gives me great pleasure to convey to you the greetings of His Excellency Dr. Abdul Karim Al-Iryani, the Foreign Minister of Yemen, who unfortunately could not participate in this historic meeting of the Security Council. May I, on this occasion, express the satisfaction of our delegation at seeing you, the distinguished Secretary of State of the United States, preside over the proceedings of this important meeting. Mr. President, it so happens that today is the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, a stark reminder of the plight of a people who have been systematically denied their basic rights to national self-determination. There is, in the Middle East region, another crisis that is not dealt with by the same standard which the Security Council has been applying to the crisis in the Gulf. What is at stake is not only the fate of the Palestinians, a displaced and tortured people, but the credibility of the Security Council. Mr. President, at the conclusion of the Paris summit last week, a momentous declaration marked the end of the Cold War. an era in contemporary history mainly characterized by ideological and military confrontation between the two competing power blocks. We are now being told that a new world order is looming in the horizon, a world order in which law is paramount and freedom is supreme. Today, however, we are not meeting here to celebrate the end of an era and the beginning of another, nor are we here to lay down a framework for the new world order, an evolving process that will nevertheless be influenced by our decision. We are here today to face the first serious challenge to the post-Cold War era, the crisis in the Gulf. Mr. President, since the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq on August 2nd, the Security Council has adopted 10 resolutions calling for the complete withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait, the immediate release of all hostages, and the restoration of the legitimate government of Kuwait. In order to ensure implementation of its resolutions, the Security Council imposed the most sweeping and enforceable sanctions regime on Iraq. Today, the Security Council has before it a draft resolution, in effect authorizing states to use force in order to implement those resolutions. In the annals of the United Nations, this will be long remembered as the war resolution. Ever since the eruption of the crisis in the Gulf, the position of Yemen has been consistent and clear, although at times it was intentionally distorted. From the very outset, Mr. President, Yemen declared that it would take a neutral stand in the conflict in order to be able to contribute in the search for a peaceful Arab solution to this conflict. Yemen also supported resolutions of the Security Council calling for the withdrawal of Iraqi forces from Kuwait and the immediate release of all hostages, as well as the restoration of the legitimate government of Kuwait. It should come as no surprise, therefore, that the Republic of Yemen cannot support a resolution that would authorize states to use force for the following specific reasons. First, the resolution before us does not exclude the use of force and is so broad and vague that it's not limited to the purpose of enforcing implementation of the 10 resolutions adopted by the Security Council on the Gulf crisis. Hence, it will be up to those states who have military forces in the area to decide on the prerequisites for the restoration of international peace and security in the region, which might as well lead to a military confrontation on a larger scale. Two, the resolution before us is not related to a specific article under Chapter 7 of the Charter. Hence, the Security Council will have no control over those forces which will fly their own flags, their own national flags. Furthermore, the command of those forces will have nothing to do with the United Nations, although their actions are authorized by the Security Council. It is, Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, a classical example of authority without accountability. Mr. President, the Republic of Yemen advocates a positive, peaceful approach to resolve the crisis in the Gulf in accordance with relevant resolutions of the Security Council. Accordingly, I would like to underline the following. The sanctions regime which the Security Council imposed on Iraq actually has no parallel in the history of the United Nations. Never before has such a comprehensive and sweeping sanctions regime been imposed on any country. One can easily assert that for all practical purposes, Iraq is completely isolated from the outside world. For a country that's almost landlocked, and can neither export anything, including oil, nor import anything, including foodstuffs, it would not take long, in our opinion, before the sanctions hurt badly and eventually force Iraq to comply and withdraw from Kuwait. Furthermore, the sanctions regime imposed on Iraq, unlike those applied earlier by the Security Council on Rhodesia, are actually being legally enforced by the presence of so many foreign ships and aircrafts. It is not being reported in the press, but many Iraqi, as well as foreign ships sailing to and from Iraqi or Kuwaiti ports, are being stopped and searched in the high seas or nearby ports in order to ascertain that no violations of the sanctions are taking place. As a matter of fact, the Security Council Committee, established by Resolution 661 to oversee the strict implementation of the sanctions regime on Iraq, has not, up to date, reported on any violations to the sanctions. It is a sanctions regime that is almost absolutely airtight. It is a little surprising, Mr. President, that those who used to lecture us on the need to be patient for sanctions to work when they had to do with Rhodesia or South Africa are today in such a hurry to declare that those comprehensive and enforceable sanctions on Iraq are simply not working. For sanctions to work and force Iraq to implement resolutions of the Security Council, we need patience. That is the alternative to a catastrophic and unpredictable military confrontation in an inflammable region of the world. But it looks like patience is a rare commodity these days. Mr. President, in addition to a strict sanctions regime, a peaceful approach to the crisis, by necessity, should involve active diplomatic engagement. Commenting on the crisis in the Gulf, a very wise man said that there were too many war scenarios, but not one peace scenario. Indeed, some impatient warriors are so terrified by the prospect of peace that they would do anything to scuttle a peace proposal and pay anything to ignite the flames of war. Is it not a little strange that the Security Council has not, for a long time, come up with one resolution that would give the Secretary General a free hand and clearly mandate him to engage in mediation efforts in order to resolve the crisis peacefully? It is true that Iraqi reaction to resolutions of the Council are not positive, nor is Iraq's response to certain initiatives encouraging. But serious diplomatic negotiations cannot be conducted openly. Mr. President, Iraq has already expressed its willingness to talk and negotiate with the United States of America. Is it not time to engage Iraq in a serious dialogue? Moreover, we hear from time to time certain constructive suggestions and initiatives that are put forward by leading figures in our own region. Shouldn't we encourage those silent moves that are very much like feelers? It is ironic that those states, which have been for years lecturing us in the Arab world about the virtues of dialogue and diplomatic negotiation, are now the ones who are saying no to peace initiatives and peace plans. Mr. President, less than 3 months before the crisis in the Gulf, North and South Yemen peacefully and democratically merged into a unitary state, the Republic of Yemen. For our country, which is situated in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, the crisis in the northern part of the peninsula is not a distant affair. Even before the eruption of war, Yemen is paying a dear price for its insistence on a policy of neutrality and its determination to pursue a peaceful approach to the crisis. To start with, Our economy has been dealt a severe blow as a consequence of our compliance with the sanctions regime and the disruption of economic relations between Yemen and both Iraq and Kuwait, particularly in activities relating to oil and refining. Moreover, around 900,000 Yemeni immigrant workers suddenly became a casualty of the crisis in the Gulf when the residence in our neighborly country, Saudi Arabia, was suspended due to new regulations. Because they only had a month to leave the country, many of them had to sell their property at distressed prices in order to meet the deadline. Mr. President, comparatively speaking, it's like having 30 million jobless Americans come back home within a short period of 2 months. You can imagine the economic strains that will be caused by this demographic dislocation. For Yemen, therefore, there is no alternative to peace without which our region would be heading towards disaster. Mr. President, it is a coincidence that the crisis in the Gulf erupted as the post-Cold War era was beginning to take shape. The way in which this crisis will be resolved will therefore definitely affect the nature and future of international economic and political relations. The war option would deprive humanity of an historic opportunity to make a smooth transition to a new world order, one that is not characterized by the military victory of one country or group of countries over others. By causing severe economic disruption and recession, a military confrontation would undermine the evolving process of democratization in many parts of the world, including my own, which is committed to genuine democratic reforms. That is why, Mr. President, we sincerely hope that peace will prevail in our region and the world at large. Let's give peace a chance. I thank you, sir.
I thank the permanent representative of Yemen to the United Nations for his statement.
The representative of Yemen concluding the first three speakers here at the United Nations as the debate continues on a use of force resolution at the UN, one sponsored by the United States. There's no doubt that the Security Council will approve that resolution. Yemen's vote at this point looks like an abstention, but we won't know for sure until the vote takes place in a little while. We'll keep tabs on all of the speeches and, of course, come back for live coverage of the vote and for live coverage of the speeches by the Cuban and Chinese foreign ministers who are both here. Both of those votes at this point are also question marks. Ralph Begleiter, CNN, reporting live from the United Nations.